new solutions for new problems. I'm going to cover six areas: the ageing itself, national productivity, retirement, staying healthy, a place to live, and then what common themes come from that. And let's just start off. Is it ageing like we've never seen before? Yes, it definitely is. If you look at a graph of how long we expect to live once we get to age 65, here it is across the last century plus, and you can see around about 1970 a steep increase in how long we expect to live once we get to age 65. If you compare the Australian life tables from 1996 against 2011, just over 15 years, the life expectancy at age 65 has gone out by nearly 3 years for the males. That's the figure. It was 16 and now it's 19 as at 2011. Females, it was two and a quarter years as well. So just in a decade and a half, we've had a quarter of a decade added to how long we expect to live once we get to age 65. Haven't seen that before. Are we alone in this? If we look at dependency ratio across the OECD, we're in the middle of the range. A little bit of explanation of this slide. You don't need to see all the countries on the bottom, but this is where we were in 2011. That's ranked in order. And you can see we're the green one. We're roughly around about the middle of OECD dependency ratios. And then this slide takes projections out to 2030 and 2060. Does the position change for Australia across those times? So the 2030 are the crosses. And you can see if we reordered them, everyone in order, we're still round about the middle. And even in 2060, with the bars, where if you reordered these columns in order, you'd still probably find our green ones round about the middle. So while we have things that we haven't seen before, we're not the only ones going through this, and we don't expect to become a serious outrider. So we'll have chances to learn, or even more importantly, chances to find things out and share them with other countries. You can also see the passage of our baby boomers through life has a big effect on that dependency ratio. When the first baby boomers are born, we're up here. When they join the working age, we're around here. And as they start to retire, we bounce up here again. And then later on, as we're baby boomers, I can say we about baby boomers, as we all die off, it gets back to another level. Just want to make an aside comment here. I said I'd drawn on papers from different areas, right? So this one is from Who Will Fund Our Health? Actuaries Institute white paper from a few years ago. And you'll see I've also drawn on a couple of other institute papers, Deloitte Access Economics, just trying to bring the separate stories together. Okay, so a few facts, a few graphs, just to establish, have we seen this before? No, we haven't. So the first question, before I start getting on to the areas where we solve the problems or where we deal with the consumer's needs, I'd like to deal with where does the money come from? And for here, I'll draw on some work done by Access Economics in particular, but also just some concepts. So the first one, the problem starts with the economy. It doesn't actually start with how do we finance it or how do we deliver the services. And if you look at our national income, three main components, population multiplied by the participation rate of people in that population, multiplied by the productivity of those people. And if we think about this area of policy, how we deal with our ageing population, the key one that stands out here is the participation rate. And if we want to have a strong economy dealing with an ageing population, then this one is particularly susceptible to what our ageing policies cover. And it can have a noticeable effect on GDP. So this table comes from a Access Economics paper. If we look at the extra increase in workforce participation that can come from harnessing people who otherwise might have retired, an extra 3% of the workforce, 1.6% extra on GDP, an extra 5%, an extra 2.4% on GDP. So not necessarily of average productivity, but still a noticeable small change in the workforce leads to a noticeable change in GDP as well. What policies have we got dealing with this area? A number of them. So obviously the increasing retirement age for government pension, the whole transition to retirement finances, which have been in place for a decade, now starting to be fine-tuned, and in some ways government may have stepped back from some of those with recent superannuation changes, but there is still a mentality developing of transition into retirement. Less and less is there a standard retirement age, and in fact discrimination on age grounds in many of its forms is illegal now. We also have this one here, encouragement of the commercial benefits of diversity. So the kind of concepts and ideas and needs being explored in that last session, particularly by Juliet Burke and the actual advantages of diverse groups. We home quite naturally onto gender because it's a big issue, but in fact age diversity is also a relevant issue in that, and part of the policy field of responding to our increased ageing population. Migration, another one. It's more to do with topping up the the younger end, and in another way, the childcare support for women to get back to work. It's not really ageing, but it is relevant to this. What do we do to increase our national productivity? So a number of policies there to deal with the more fundamental question of how will our productivity support this ageing population. Going to move on to the areas where it has to outwork. So the first one, retirement from the workforce, where you'd probably summarise it to say we've got established policies, they're nearing fruition. Three pillar core policy for retirement financing, artistically drawn here by my slide producer as three beds instead of three pillars, but that's okay. Some serious strengths, the funding, universality, even the competing models we've got, the SMSFs versus the industry funds versus the commercial funds, I think that's a serious strength that people are looking for different ways to organise the retirement finances. Some weaknesses I'll come back to. Savings phase, progressing well. These are some figures from the Deloitte Super Report drawn on APRA statistics. Dark blue is the pre-retirement savings. Light green is the post-retirement savings. And here the thing to watch is 2014, that kind of size compared to, 2035, so 20 years later. So a tripling of the post-retirement funds. And of course continued growth in the pre-retirement as well. So the savings phase is going fine, and it's actually making a significant impact on people's retirement wealth in most segments. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this slide. There's two graphs there. It's taken from another Institute paper, For Richer, For Poorer, which was Actuary's white paper from August 2015. So I've got here... this is the projected wealth at age 65 in current dollars as at 2015. I've got two slides here. The first one covers median wealth and below, and the second one covers median wealth and above. And you can see 1.34 million, 1.34 million, but there's a difference in the axes. Right? So... first point to note, we look at around about 400k, 800k is material when you're looking at these side of the population, but 1.5 million is material when you look at this part of the graph. So there's quite a diversity in the projected savings at age 65. The third thing to look at is we've got superannuation, non-superannuation, and non-super savings. And the non-superannuation is split into housing and other savings. So light green is housing, blue is superannuation, purple is the other savings. And then the fourth bit to understand in this picture is we have people who are currently age 30, and we have people who are currently age 60. Currently age 30, currently age 60, currently age 30, currently age 60. So this is quite a detailed look at the accumulating wealth for people age 65. It's produced from an institute paper a couple of years ago, and it shows us by the percentiles of income, it shows us by where the different incomes are. If we stand back and what lessons do we take from this? Number one, the superannuation is making a difference. Until you get up to this kind of area, all these other socioeconomic groups, the continued emphasis on superannuation funding makes a real difference at age 65. The people who are currently age 30 and have it all their working life have much more superannuation built up. Even at median wealth, have much more superannuation built up than people who are currently age 60 and haven't had that all through their life. Next thing to note is interesting as well, and I'll just go back to the median wealth. These people have much more wealth in homes than these people, right? The current 60-year-olds, when they get to 65, projected to have more wealth in their home than today's 30-year-olds. And when you look for an explanation for that, one of them is the difficulty now for today's 30-year-olds to get into the housing market, which is a current news issue. It wasn't such a news issue when the Institute wrote this paper, but there it was in the numbers in that paper as well. And so when we look at the ageing policies, this degree of home ownership, quite good for the next decade, decade and a half, 2 decades, and I'll come back to that again. If we were looking at ageing and what to do about the aged further out, we might find that that is, and that is a problem. I'm not going to dwell any more on this. There's good data there. It shows the superannuation system is working. It shows it's not the only system for accumulating wealth. It's working in the accumulation phase. That was up to age 65. But I'd have to say, I think the jury's still out on whether the system is working in the disbursement phase. Again, from For Richer, For Poorer, the same couples, left-hand column is always people now age 30. These are people age 60, age 30, 60, and the five wealth median groupings. The 25th percentile, that part of our population doesn't reach that purple dotted line until these 30-year-olds are getting to age 65, 35 years away. Why does that purple dotted line matter? Because that is ASFA's comfortable living level, right? So entirely a quarter of our population is sitting below that comfortable living, right? When you add in government pension, everyone is above the ASFA modest living, but whether that is a good approach, not sure. Then we get into, does it work for everybody? So on average, maybe you can make a case it's working on average, right? But the adequacy of benefits, just question that. The variability of benefits in a defined contribution world, there is massive variability that can arise due to different investment paths, due to different timings of savings, due to different timings of disbursement and the need for particular lumps of expenditure and so on. So very difficult to have a predictable stream of income in a defined contribution world. We still get subsectors who are not well served, even in the growth phase. So career interruptions, split couples, people end up not necessarily with the right income. Okay, and then there's another one that I've questioned. These are graphs of the annual income that you could afford up until your life expectancy. It's an Institute paper. It's an Institute of Actuaries white paper. What's the measure they've used for income? How much can you have if you plan to run out at life expectancy? That's a problem. Right? Two-thirds of people will still live after their life expectancy. And yet even our Institute, when we try to illustrate is the superannuation system going to work in the disbursement phase, even our Institute in a white paper uses the measure of income to life expectancy. And I think that's perhaps the single biggest reason why the jury is still out on are our retirement policies working in the disbursement phase. It's because we don't yet have a way of systematically managing people's income through to retirement. We don't even talk about it. There is significant wealth locked up in housing, those graphs a couple of slides ago, and we don't have a systemic way to deploy this into paying for our aged either. We certainly have some reverse mortgage products and so on, not widely taken up. My perception is that the link between those products and the move into aged care is problematic, and probably the one systemic way where we can translate housing wealth into retirement needs is at that point of moving into aged care where many families sell the family home, move into the aged care, and then have a place to live for the rest of their life with care attached to it. Okay, so the fundamental policy of compulsory contributions is firm. It's always getting tinkered with. Colour coding here, red is if it would mean less money for superannuation, green for if it actually makes the thing work better. There's quite a significant value judgment in that colour coding. So limiting benefits to 1.6 million, limiting funds to 1.6 million or cutting off things, it's coded red here, but that value judgment, many other people might make the value judgment that that kind of thing is necessary for the sustainability of the whole system, the way that our society hangs together and the way that it fits into the national productivity and economic framework. So it's easy to get sucked into value judgments which on reflection are too sweeping. And these are my colour codings, red and green, and I'm just not claiming to be any better than anyone else in that kind of way. One of the current issues is to deal with the question that I've talked about the income running out. And so there's a government investigation into this comprehensive income product for retirement, other sessions on the program about that. So I'm not going to say anything other than it's looking for a financial system product which will balance the flexibility that you get when you can take what you need, what you want out of your pension, but also the security you get when your longevity risk is managed by the product instead of by your financial advisor and your spending habits. Retirement. We've done well tucking some money aside, and now we can deal with the problems of how you disperse that money. Much better situation than if we didn't have the money in the first place. Let's come to health. We don't just have more older people, but more services per old person. So this is whether you look at it in terms of how often do we go to hospital, or whether you look at it in terms of cost, then the change, 27.8 up to 2013, 5 years, the change in these is much higher at the oldest ages. These are the old ages. These are the young ages. That's around 2.5% to 3% growth per annum. And this over here is around about 8% growth per annum when you look at the cost per person. And they're both focused up at the older ages, a bit of a lump there with young kids in their primary school ages. But generally, not just do we have more older people, but they are requiring more health services and the cost is going up faster than it is for the per capita rate for younger people. We've got chronic disease growth going on in Australia. Obesity, diabetes, a couple of other very serious ones. This chart, which is an OECD chart, but taken from a green paper on health, again produced by the Institute. We've got Australia sitting up there. This is the obesity rates, year by year, 1972, 2012. The trend is upwards. It's upwards in all these countries, Australia, USA, Mexico, Canada. But we are sitting up there right up the top, Mexico and US above us, England, similar, and then you've got Canada, Spain, France, Italy, Korea, way down here. So we have a compounding impact that these chronic diseases make it far more complicated to treat older people even than they are now. So another looming problem. There's a basket of solutions needed, and they fall into a couple of groups. Efficiency, best practice, harnessing the technology, make what we do work better. Quality of care, integrated and patient-centred, data availability, shared across the sources, longitudinal. It means we can go more and more into the detail of what's needed for individual cases, and we have the information and the data to equip that. So more focused care. The next one, pre-funding this predictable need, so we can see that we're going to be spending more on health in years to come. If you look for where is our national policy on pre-funding this, there isn't one. The closest you get is superannuation affordability, where it's kind of wrapped into that. And you can look at other countries, some other countries around the world where they have tackled that. In Australia, we're not there yet. The last two are, I think, really important and not yet fully recognised. And they are about the choices we make both individually and as society. So we have I've just shown a slide of chronic diseases, and our personal habits contribute to that. Chronic disease growth. If we want to have good health in old age, we need to take personal responsibility through it, through our lives. And there are things you do actively to stay healthy. There are also things you refrain from doing. And our system, we don't have a serious policy response to that need yet. The next one is also about choices, and it's comes to an issue of affordability. We're spending more and more on health. As a society, we like to have Medicare covering more things, and we like to have our health insurers pay out on more things. And in fact, as we get more and more disposable income, the marginal importance of staying healthy or becoming healthy is much more important than the marginal importance of some other things that were important as we had less wealth. So you expect, actually, to be spending more on health as you get richer. The choice to be made here is to take the responsibility for that, work through the implications of it as a society, and understand that if our national productivity keeps going up and our national income keeps going up, then it's actually quite good news that we can get to spend more on health, which becomes marginally a higher priority. These are both about taking responsibility for choices that we make as a person and as a society. We already make those choices. We don't necessarily make them well, but the more that we take the responsibility for those choices, the better the impact in the long run on the health system. aged care. And how am I going for time here? Are we finishing 12:45 or 12:40? Okay. Aged care is another sector. Increasing attention on individuals' needs. Bit of a snapshot. These are figures from 2013-14. The total revenue across that sector is about $18 billion, which at that time was roughly the same as the revenue flowing through private health insurance. So a sector similar in size to private health insurance sector. There's home-based community care, which is like the entry-level care needs. And then there is the much more comprehensive residential care, and then growing home care where the kind of standard of care is closer to the residential one rather than the entry level. At that time, nearly 250,000 people in residential care, another 83,000 in the home-based care needs, and another 750,000 getting some kind of early entry-level community health centre kind of thing for aged care. There's adjacent industries, of course, the hospital and medical services and the residential villages. But as a snapshot, if you wanted to take one figure away, the money flowing through these a few years ago was about the same size as the money flowing through private health insurance. The funding method for aged care, there's another thing to look at this. In the residential care part, total revenue of $14.8 billion, of which $9.8 comes from the government. So two-thirds is funded by the government, one-third funded by individuals. In that community area, it's much more of a government operation, and local government comes into play as well. And so that's two-thirds of it comes from the Commonwealth government. The method for it, anyone who's worked in the US on long-term care or Singapore's Elder Shield or UK long-term care, very familiar with the ADL kind of basis of estimating claims and payouts required. So for our aged care sector, 10 areas where the activities of daily living are monitored and measured, and the aged care homes update this all the time, and residents move between one of 64 categories pretty much as frequently as they actually in real life move. The government payments depend on which of those 64 classifications you're placed in, and it allows the hospital staff to categorise individuals really effectively as individuals rather than just saying, we've got a bunch of low-care people and we've got a bunch of high-care people. And when individuals move their classification, it'll come to the staff's attention because it's their own movement. There won't be lots of people moving from this category to that category at the same time. It was introduced 27 as a very serious policy measure. It replaced a per diem method. The policies have been updated in 2013, and in fact the Productivity Commission put an investigation into this sector as well to see what was working, identified a range of issues ranging from, say, the health status and the consumer preferences through to finances or workforce pressures. The government responded with an entire policy framework, living longer, living better, which is progressively being implemented, and some of the elements of that were put in place as recently as February this year. The outcomes we're looking for: quality of care, consumer choice, stable funding, including for the upcoming needs as the people in these age groups get more numerous, and the balance of business and private funding, and the balance of not-for-profit provision like UnitingCare versus for-profit provision like Thompson or Bupa. As that balance changes, the funding needs to be stable, and a growing workforce needed in the area. So these are some of the policy responses to the ageing in this area, and some of those responses are susceptible to actuarial analysis. The government support is means tested. I'm not going to go into these except to show there's a assets test and there's an income test, and you can lose government support by failing either one of them. And there's also an area in here where you get full support, and so, you know, socially progressive funding policy means tested. And the numbers on that slide are out of date, but the general concept of green, blue and grey is the general concept. I'm going to move on. Don't try to read those slides. So, aged care. Another area of policy, dealing with some things that are susceptible to actuarial thinking. If I stand back, what kind of common themes emerge? For markets, fabulous consumer market, growing wealth, unfulfilled needs and desires, complexity though for providers, real need to understand what people want. Moving on. The markets are capable now of tracking and responding much better to changes in consumer needs. So whether you're looking at how you get to your customers with the channels, right, or whether you look at how you design your product, much better able to do it. The extra data and knowledge available cuts two ways. Providers are able to better design what they do for customers, but on the same time, customers have much better self-knowledge and can use that to look for the best deals, and so there's a bit of a commercial battle along that axis. But at the end of the day too, trust, particularly in this part of the market where competence, capability starts to decline, familiarity with the latest concepts starts to not get so automatically refreshed as it does when you're in working age, the trust in your providers becomes way more important. An example of the data available, this is a stylized analysis of home care needs, meal preparation, property maintenance, household chores, transport, reading or writing tasks. So you can get that the number of cases required, the age group of those cases. Down is another graph of how those needs were met. This has been kind of de-identified from a real-life study, and is just here to illustrate that data can be used way better to analyse what the needs are in this sector, feeding back into market's ability to meet that sector's needs. But highly complex system for retirees to navigate. So you've got all the influencers, you've got all the people that have an impact, you've got the whole thing about Centrelink processes and how you keep up to speed with Centrelink processes. And to me, that says that there's a growing requirement, the advisory services in this area, whether they come from social services or financial advisors or growing aged care advisor market, the trust thing is really necessary. Standing it all together, I've looked at three sectors. I've drawn at, in fact, four when you count the economy. I've drawn papers from different sectors where people who work in those sectors have put their best knowledge together, produce those papers. But you can't separate them. People live their lives in that middle space, and anyone seriously wanting to serve those people need to have an understanding of all three of those, and there's no doubt other sectors as well that I haven't covered here. The whole person needs need to be met. So, themes. The need to coordinate across sectors. Consumer-driven choices, whether it's the retirement, individual plans, whether it's the aged care, individual needs met, or you could even look at the NDIS, again, the patient-centred care in health and the customer-centred care in NDIS. A serious theme. Data that makes those themes more realistic, And also, I've mentioned a couple of times without actually drawing out, a lot of public-private partnership going on here. Mixed government and private funding, government policy implemented by markets generally. And if I home in on an actuarial audience, what does this mean for actuaries? All those sectors actually do have issues where actuarial approaches can be valuable, but if you want to work with clients in any of those sectors and help them make changes, you need to understand there will be flow on to their clients from these other sectors as well. And if you want to just specialise in one traditional area, you'll end up missing the integrated customer view. Okay. I'll pass back to... Well, I'll take questions or I'll... Yeah, take questions or comments if there are any. I'd make one other observation. On any one of these issues, I expect there's someone on the floor in the audience who knows more about it than I do. My aim here is not to create a specialty in this. My aim is to stand back and the need for collaborate among people who understand the different issues. Richard.
Stuart. Richard Lyon from TAL. I don't think I am one of those many people in the audience who knows more about anything. I enjoyed that. It was a good bringing together of a few things. I would throw a couple of other things into the mix. One of them was you showed the dependency ratios. I wonder whether you actually think dependency ratios mean anything anymore in a context of a fluid approach to retirement and a much longer expectation of life than when dependency ratios were first dreamed up. And even the bottom end of the dependency ratio has changed. Our kids are at university instead of out there helping to feed the family. And the second thing is... You have a focus on improved longevity, which is a very, I think, sensible focus. But I wonder what you think about what's going on in the UK, where they're measuring deteriorating mortality, which is a bit of a surprise, I would have thought. And it's clearly not obesity-driven because they're in the same position as us.
Okay, dependency ratio, I think at a high level, it illustrates things which... It illustrates potential problems, and if you solve those problems, it becomes less meaningful. But the first step in dealing with what you said would be to step away from just one person counts as a whole person and get some kind of fraction of how much they're contributing into the paid economy versus how much they're not. So I think there's a few steps to go before it becomes totally irrelevant. But even though things are changing, as long as you look at it as illustrating where the issues lie and illustrating that things have changed, then I think it's really useful. The mortality improvement one, I do think that's very interesting, and we don't know, right? We don't actually know. We're probably wise to play on the safe side and assume we'll live longer than we might expect rather than shorter. But here again, some of those ways that we live our lives come into play. So you could work with a theory that says the people who contributed to the mortality rates above age 70 over the last three decades... They as children, they had a regime of wartime and maybe of depression, and then of the period straight after the war where there wasn't the wide range of tasty, salty, sugary foods available. So you could want to be seeing some effects of that. But I just don't know the answer, Richard, and I think it matters that the kind of change I showed actually has happened in real life. So to ignore that and assume it'll just go away, I don't think that's tenable. Any other? Oh, there's the bill. I think, Andrew, I can hand back to you.
I'll ask you a question, another question in. Thanks, Stuart, for that, trying to draw together the three aspects of your retirement income. So what you've got coming in, but then your expenditure. So, you know, in retirement you've got living costs, and I think one of the charts you showed, the younger people perhaps won't have so much housing wealth in future. Maybe there'll be more expenditure on rent for in retirement ages. So, you know, that's perhaps another thing that needs to come into the mix. And then, of course, the unknowns of health costs, and we know how variable that can be, and aged care costs. Some people will require aged care and others won't. So, you know, it just seems to be such a massive challenge to run individual sort of accumulation model for what are quite variable expenditures in retirement. I don't know whether you think there is any scope for a re-emergence of collective funding vehicles to deal with some of that. We seem to have moved away from collective ways of dealing with funding to individual ones.
Yeah, look, I certainly think there's scope for financial products that collectivise the longevity risk, which is the one you're most talking about. And there are some insurance vehicles that help collectivise the medical risks. There's another risk that I mentioned, the risk that you won't be able to navigate your way through the system, the need for advisories. And as I've put this story together, I've come to think that personal networks are really important there as well, and policies that promote personal networks. So in old days we might have said families, where I'm now saying personal networks, but the nuclear family doesn't have kids of the next generation who can automatically look after their parents anymore. I think that one of the really important ways to navigate through that network, particularly when your experience is different from the average, as you were just talking about, will be to have strong personal networks that help you navigate through the system in what's available. And that's an area where I don't see any policy at the moment, but I think will be maybe a quite important requirement.
Okay, well, it looks like we've run out of time, so would you join me in thanking Stuart for his presentation?